Ira and Peter, and now we're going to hear from a new friend who is not yet part of our group. His name is Jim Pashinich, and he's from... No, we didn't tell him that, though. You tackle him at the door, please, Jonathan. He is a member of the research team at the New York Historical Society, whom we commissioned to put together a presentation just for us, which will then be available for them to use in other places, on New York City in the 30s and 40s. And so I give you Jim Pashinich.
Thank you. I'm not going to use this microphone. Can you hear me clearly?
Yes.
Okay. I've got a loud mouth. I give tours there, so I'm used to yelling.
Can we turn the lights down a bit?
You could. I'll have to be off because I can't read if you do that.
But. Then we'll leave it as it is.
Well, thank you for inviting me. The New York Historical Society is the oldest museum in the city of New York. It is the second oldest historical society in the country after the Charleston Historical Society. And what Marilyn had asked us to do is to create the atmosphere of New York, Nero Wolfe's New York in the 1930s. Rob is going to help me turn that, so go ahead. New York, I'm going to talk about New York in the 30s and 40s, the cultural, the creativity, and the climate of the time. Also, we're going to meet some of the people and the personalities who so thoroughly ingrained themselves in the city during that period. It was a fun city, and at the same time, it was a desperate city, in some ways defined by some of the spectacular crimes of the era. So let's look at New York City in the Nero Wolfe era. 1930, the Depression was entering its second year. Prohibition, which was supposed to eliminate crime, entered the 11th year as organized crime's biggest booster. And himself, Bo James, Jimmy Walker, was the mayor. A move to replace the elevated trains with the underground ones was reaching fruition, and no street got more attention than 42nd Street, and as an unsurpassed building boom was beginning. I'm fine. In 1925, vaudeville had 1,300 theaters on its circuit.
Oh my God.
By 1930, there were 300 left. In May of 1931, the great Broadway producer David Belasco died at the age of 75. Rob? The drama Green Grows the Lilacs ran for four performances. And with it, Franch Othone played Curly. June Walker was Laurie. It told the story of a life and love in Oklahoma before it was statehood. By the way, Tex Ritter, the cowboy, was the standby for Franch Othone. We will visit that story a decade later. A George and Ira Gershwin tune entry had more success. Girl Crazy, which introduced two megastars for the next decade, Ethel Merman and Ginger Rogers, enjoyed a run of 227 performances, and charmed the audience with such standards as Biding My Time, But Not For Me, Embraceable You, and this entry, play it, George Gershwin. Thank you. Gershwin was said to have told Miss Merman, never but never go near a voice teacher. Can't you just imagine Ethel Merman singing that song? Pearl S. Buck was writing her blockbuster, The Good Earth, and at lunch at Lou Chow's, which would last 3 hours, would start with a dozen oysters, would cost all of 45 cents. Now, on August 6, 1930, Judge Joseph Forrest Crater disappeared. Judge Crater was born in eastern Pennsylvania, educated at Lafayette College, Columbia Law School. He started out of law school his own law practice. He wisely joined the Democratic Club and saw his law practice flourish thanks to the connections with the corrupt Democratic leadership in Tammany Hall. Next one, Rob. At April 30th, Crater became an associate justice in the New York State Supreme Court at the age of 41, a young age for such a prestigious position. Bank accounts later revealed that he withdrew $20,000 shortly before taking up the position. $20,000 was equal to about a year's salary, and that was about what Tammany Hall payoff required for such a lucrative position. It proved to be a good investment. While acting as an official receiver in a bankruptcy case, Crater sold a hotel property to a mortgage and finance company for $75,000. 2 months later, the city agreed to buy back that property so it could widen the street and bought it for the condemned property price just short of $3 million. He also had great fortune in his personal life. In 1916, a woman named Stella Wheeler retained him as a divorce trial, and the next year, right after the divorce was final, she became Mrs. Joseph Crater. His marriage, you can go back to that, Rob. His marriage did not stop the judge from dating showgirls. And just before his disappearance with his wife vacationing in Maine, he took a showgirl friend down to Atlantic City. His disappearance captured New York's attention, and in fact, the nation's attention for the rest of the decade. His case was considered to be the biggest missing persons case in American history. In October of that year, a grand jury began looking into the case, called 95 witnesses, had 975 pages of testimony, and it was determined that the evidence was insufficient to determine whether Crater was dead or alive. Authorities reasoned that Crater had crossed or cheated a powerful criminal figure, and they extracted their revenge. In 1939, he was declared officially dead, but rumors of his sighting, particularly on the anniversary of his disappearance, continued year in and year out. Comics would use the line, "Judge Crater, call home," or people who were known to disappear quickly were known to be cratered. In 1930 was the time that New York City grew up. It was a real estate people who saw that the streets of New York were dirty and noisy and blocked from sunlight by the elevated trains, so the trains had to go. While New Yorkers were digging underground for the subways, other construction was digging above ground, creating a skyline for which New York would be forever famous. No street saw more magnificent skyscrapers than 42nd Street when Cornelius Vanderbilt's trade terminal was replaced by the new Grand Central Station 101 years ago in 1913. The signal went out that 42nd Street was the new heart of the city. Businesses and people began to move there. In 1920, the Bowery Savings Bank moved its executive offices to 42nd and Park Avenue. In fact, I signed my first mortgage in that building. And 1930 saw the buildings explode into great heights and accomplishments. The king of the tabloid journalism, the New York Daily News, built a 37-story Art Deco skyscraper on 222 East 42nd Street in 1930. On that site, just west of the New York Daily News building, the Art Deco's greatest monument would appear when Van Allen's 40-story Chrysler building was completed, and for a brief moment reigned as the world's tallest building. But the Chrysler Building would quickly lose that title to what is possibly New York's most famous building, the Empire State Building. Construction on the Empire State Building began on 34th Street on October 1st, 1929. Despite the financial difficulties of the Great Depression, New Yorkers marveled at the Empire State Building as it grew story by story. While construction business temporarily suffered a depression, projects that had already begun before the Depression were completed during the Depression. Projects like the George Washington Bridge, the aforementioned Chrysler Building, and the Empire State. The work slowdown provided these constructions with an advantage of hiring the finest out-of-work craftsmen and tradesmen in the construction business. None received greater advantage than the Empire State Building. There was such competition for work on the Empire State Building that most of the accomplished tradesmen would not take a day off under any circumstances, knowing that there was another equally skilled worker waiting to take that job. The building worked with such highly skilled and highly motivated employees, erected a floor every day, 4.5 floors a week throughout the construction. However, when the building opened on May 1st, 1931, the office space went unrented. Despite the influence of President Al Smith, the Empire State Corporation teetered on the brink of bankruptcy for years. The lack of renters led New York to refer to the building as the Empty State Building. The building would not become profitable until 1960. In 1925, the slim, elegant personification of the jazz age, Jimmy Walker took over City Hall. In the initial years, as Mayor Walker saw the city prosper and many public works projects gain traction, he created the Department of Sanitation, unified the New York public hospitals, improved many parks and playgrounds, guided the Board of Transportation to enter into a contract to construct an expanded subway, and remarkably, even managed to maintain the 5-cent subway fare despite a threatened strike by workers. And Bo James was known to conduct most of the city business from a box seat in Yankee Stadium. In the second term, 1929 to 33, while the Depression was destroying New York City's economy, the money started rolling into the mayor's pockets from businessmen seeking municipal contracts. He further weakened his reputation by openly conducting an extramarital affair with actress Betty Comptin. Investigations by Stephen Seabury revealed that Bo James had received many secret payments from businessmen, and Governor Franklin Roosevelt forced Walker to resign. The Walker era came to end in 1932. Walker left New York and his wife and traveled in Europe with Miss Comptin. He later returned to New York, divorced his wife, married Miss Comptin, and never again held public office. New York City was one of the hardest hit areas in the country during the Great Depression. By March 1930, there were 50 bread lines in the Lower East Side alone, serving 50,000 meals a day to the hungry. By 1932, half of the manufacturing plants in New York were closed, one out of every three New Yorkers were unemployed, and roughly 1.6 million New Yorkers were on some form of relief. The city was unprepared to deal with this crisis. Abandonment of women and children by husbands and fathers increased 134% during the first few years of the crisis. Vacancy rates nearly doubled as the number of people who could pay rent disappeared. Next. That could be the Manhattan, yeah, it might be the Manhattan Bridge, but it's down the Lower East Side. In 1933, in November, saw the election of Fiorello LaGuardia. LaGuardia, by the way, lost in a landslide to Walker in 1929. He was the mayor of New York. He was the first descendant of a Southern and Eastern European immigrants ever elected to the mayor's office, and he was truly a man of the people. His father was Italian. His mother was Jewish from Trieste in the Austro-Hungarian Empire. He spoke Hungarian, Hebrew, Yiddish, Italian, and German, and of course English. Once in office, he appointed Jews, Italians, as well as blacks to important positions in an unprecedented numbers. Those he displaced were mainly Irish, especially those supporters of his political antagonist, Tammany Hall, who had previously dominated city government. LaGuardia revitalized New York City. He restored public faith in City Hall. He unified the transit system, directed buildings, the buildings of low cost and public housing, public playgrounds and parks, constructed airports, reorganized the police force, and defeated the powerful Tammany Hall political machine, and reestablished merit employment in place of patronage jobs. LaGuardia was a tireless and vocal champion of progressive causes, from everything from allowing more immigration to removing U.S. troops in Nicaragua to speaking for the rights and livelihoods of striking miners, impoverished farmers, oppressed minorities, and struggling families. Next slide, Bob. LaGuardia was a longtime supporter of Franklin Roosevelt, particularly his New Deal. And New York City greatly benefited from that support, capturing 20% of all the jobs offered by the Civil Works Administration, the CWA. 4,000 projects employed 200,000 workers during the first three-month-long program. Furthermore, studies found that the New York City CWA program was the most honestly and effectively managed in the country. LaGuardia also competed for the Public Works Administration programs as well as federal funds. By 1935, New York City was capturing 1/7 of all federal outlay for relief. In addition, it was the only city to administer its own WPA projects, generating another 200,000 jobs. Next slide. Franklin Roosevelt on March 4th left the New York Capitol in Albany and was sworn in as the President of the United States. Roosevelt quickly established a New Deal in response to the Great Depression. Roosevelt's series of domestic programs focused on what historians call the three R's: relief, recovery, and reform. Relief for unemployment and the poor, recovery for an economy to normal levels, and reform of a financial system to prevent a repeat depression. These sweeping new programs proposed by President Roosevelt included the Civil Works Administration, Civil Conservation Corps, Farm Credit Administration, the Homeowners Loan Corporation, the Tennessee Valley Authority, the Public Works Administration, and the National Industrial Recovery Program. And on December 5th, 1933, saw the ratification of the 21st Amendment, finally ending prohibition in the United States. It began 13 years before with the 18th Amendment, or the Volstead Act, and went into effect immediately. Next. Prohibition created new opportunities for the leaders of organized crime. Many of these mob bosses recognized the advantage of the harbor for illegal importation of alcohol, known as rub running. Police Commissioner Grover Whalen estimated that the city had 32,000 speakeasies, twice the number of legal saloons the city had before Prohibition. The area on 52nd Street between 5th and 6th was reputed to be the greatest concentration of these speakeasies. Now the CBS headquarters is there. New York City not only provided the nation with much of its alcohol, but many of its soon-to-be infamous organized crime leaders, including Johnny Torrio and Al Capone. Both men began their criminal careers in Brooklyn before moving to Chicago. Murder reached a peak during the Prohibition, when violence worsened as crime gangs were reorganized. The Mafia developed a peculiar American institution, a family of organized crime. In most cities, one Mafia family was in control. In New York, there were five families known by the surnames of their leaders: the Genovese, the Bonanno, the Gambino, Profaci, and Lucchese. The new generation of organized crime leaders included Charles Lucky Luciano, Meyer Lansky, Frank Costello, Albert Anastasia, and Joe Adonis. Next slide. Charles Lucky Luciano was seen by many as the father of modern organized crime in America. Luciano and his accomplices gave organized crime in New York a stability and a structure it had lacked, and helped to make a formidable force in American life. As gangs imported liquor and distributed it throughout the nation, they accepted conventional business techniques and redefined their relations with government. And they continued to do so after the repeal of the Prohibition in 1933. At the same time, organized crime in the city focused increasingly on narcotics, gambling, prostitution, and waterfront racketeering. Prohibition was finally repealed in 1933, but by then, the Great Depression was in full force. Honest jobs were hard to come by, and the dishonest ones seemed more attractive than standing in soup lines. Next. Enforcing the law in mafia families was a thug named Abe Relis, known in the underworld as Kid Twist. Relis, an enforcer, ran a group called Murder Incorporated, whose punishment for disobedience was death. In 1936, LaGuardia appointed a special crime prosecutor named Thomas E. Dewey, a future Republican presidential candidate who singled out Lucky Luciano for prosecution. Dewey had successfully investigated into Luciano's lucrative prostitution operation and eventually finding him guilty and sent Luciano to jail for a 30 to 50 year sentence. But Kid Twist, Abe Relis, was not the only person that committed murder in New York. On April 10, 1936, next slide, Nancy Tenderton, a 34-year-old writer and book reviewer, was found dead in an empty bathtub in her apartment on 22 Beekman Place. Next. She was raped and strangled and her body left unclothed except for a pair of rolled-up stockings. The pajamas she had worn the night before were wrapped around her neck. The murder made headlines in New York because it was so brutal. Adding to the media fascination was the fact that Tenderton was well-known in literary circles and her husband was an executive at the fledgling NBC network. Next. Also, crimes so vicious like that did not happen on posh Beekman Place, a two-block residential area in the East 50s. Investigators found ligature marks on the victim's wrist indicating that she had been tied up before she was raped, and the rope apparently had been cut off and taken away. Next. Luckily, police found evidence to work with. Underneath Tenderton's body in the bathtub was a 13-inch cord similar to a cord in a Venetian blind. They traced the cord back to a Pennsylvania upholstery warehouse, and it just so happens that two men who had discovered Tenderton's body were from the local upholstery shop, and they had delivered a couch to the apartment. One of the delivery men, the shop's owner, was cleared. The other, a 24-year-old assistant named John Fiorenza, had spent time in prison, where a psychiatrist had labeled him as a possible psychopath. Police brought Fiorenza into questioning. He admitted he had raped and murdered Tenderton, and who he had met the day before when he came to the apartment to pick up the couch. Next. A detective explained, quote, he claimed that he had returned to the apartment convinced that Nancy Tenderton had fallen for him during their brief encounter the day before. When she rebuffed him, he became so furious, he tied her up, raped her, and afterwards he strangled her and left her in the bathtub. Convicted of murder, in a trial that started 6 weeks after the slaying, Fiorenza went to the electric chair in Sing Sing in January of 37. 1937. Broadway saw the initial collaboration of Richard Rodgers and Lorenz Hart in an entitled play called Babes in Arms. It ran for 289 performances. Golden Boy and Joel enjoyed a run of 250 performances. And John Steinbeck's masterpiece of Mice and Men ran for 207 performances. Next. Leo Steiner and his partner Milton Parker opened up the soon-to-be-famous Carnegie Deli. It is today the most visited restaurant in New York City, the Arno restaurant excluded. J.R.R. Tolkien's novel The Hobbit was published, and there were three offerings by Agatha Christie. Ernest Hemingway wrote To Have and Have Not, and that was on the book stands, along with Rex Stout's The Red Fox, the fourth installment in the Nero Wolfe series. But you knew that. Next. The same year, Columbia Pictures released The League of Frightened Men, its adaptation of the second Nero Wolfe novel. Lionel Strander played Archie Goodwin. Walter Connolly took over the role as Nero Wolfe. Fiorello LaGuardia was elected to a second term as mayor, and in July 1937, the Buchenwald concentration camp was opened in Germany. The Depression in 1937 hit New York ferociously. The economy had bottomed out in the winter of 1932 and 33. When FDR came to office in March of 33, the Roosevelt Recovery Plan, the New Deal, brought about major realignment in American politics. His New Deal plan saw a four-year rapid growth in the economy until 1937, when the recession stopped the growth and brought the unemployment back to 1934 levels. 1937 was also the intermediate year between the two most remarkable sporting events of the decade, the two most talked about boxing matches of the 20th century. There are times in sports where sports assume a broader, more significant meaning, when the result of the sporting competition has a deeper cultural, social, and political purpose. In 1930s, two boxing matches between African-American Joe Louis and German Max Smilling highlighted the dichotomy between the public and private dynamics of sport. The public dynamic of race, color, and ethnicity, and pending world war. Racial issues were not only confined to black and white. Judaism was the third element in this peculiar racial mix of the 1930s. Next. Max Schmeling was embraced by Hitler and the Nazis, portrayed as an extreme example of German manhood, the superiority of the Aryan race. Though Schmeling was not actually a Nazi, he was still subject to attacks by Jewish Americans, and attempts were made to have his fights boycotted. This further confused the boxing scene in America, especially in New York, where boxing was dominated by promoters, managers, and fans who were Jewish. Next. The first Louis Schmeling fight took place on June 18, 1936. Schmeling achieved a knockout in the 12th round by noticing a weakness in Louis's left jab. The rematch occurred 2 years and 4 days later on June 22, 1938. The fight ended in 2 minutes and 4 seconds of the first round when Louis pounded Schmeling and Schmeling's seconds threw in the towel. The second fight incurred an atmosphere of likely war in Europe and increased reports of anti-Semitism in Germany. It was estimated that more than 100 million people around the globe listened to that fight on radio. Next. Across the ocean, Spain was on a self-destructive course of civil war, which would remake that country and begin the prelude to what was to come, setting the stage for Europe erupting into the flames of a Second World War. New York City's participation in the Civil War was through a group that would appear on the Attorney General's list of subversive activities. Many of the U.S. citizens fought in the Abraham Lincoln Brigade, and many of those folks were from New York City and the metropolitan area. On a personal level, I was stationed in the Army in New York City in the 1970s in military intelligence, and the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was still on the Attorney General's list of subversive activities in 1970. The organization had long gone, but it was still on that list. Of the 2,800 who fought in the Lincoln Brigade, 800 died in Spain, fighting Spain's Third Republic against Spanish nationalists led by Francisco Franco. Next. In the Basque city of Guernica, the Condor Legion of the German Luftwaffe would for the first time turn his ferocious force of the Blitzkrieg upon a city that helped turn the war in Franco's favor. Pablo Picasso would immortalize that bloodshed in his famous painting. In June of 1937, Neville Chamberlain, in his first speech as a British Prime Minister, inexplicably congratulates Nazi Germany for its supposed military restraint. In New York City, the legal system was recovering from the spectacular trial of the preceding year, the trial of Vera Stretz. Next. Vera Stretz was a 29-year-old who lived in the very same Very Tony address, 22 Beekman Place, as the unfortunate Nancy Tinderton. In December of 1934, while on a cruise, she met Dr. Fritz Gebhardt, a 42-year-old German financier. Chatting in their native German, they became casual friends. Soon after returning to New York, Stretz and the doctor dated. Witty and gallant, Gebhardt seemed determined to sweep Vera Stretz off her feet. Unfortunately, he had a wife and two children in Germany. The marriage that the marriage, the doctor said, was in name only for the past 10 years. Vera Stritch would later say that he told me that he loved me, and he said that he was an unusual person. Ordinary laws applied to ordinary people, but he was an unusual person, and there must be different standards. I was fascinated by them. Stritch found herself so deeply in love that in May they traveled to Lake George, she as Mrs. Gebhardt. Soon Stritch moved into Gebhardt's building in Beekman Towers, taking an apartment two floor below his. As he traveled often, they exchanged passionate love letters. In early November, when he returned from Europe, he said, "I'm going away in December and you're going with me." Stritch assumed that he had decided to end his marriage. "I'd better hurry and get the wedding invitations out." "No," he said. He knew now that he was not the type to get married. They would go on as before. Stritch said no. She would not compromise. She wanted a home and a husband. "No one had ever left me before," he announced, "and you're not going to leave me." Late on November, on the date of November 11th, Armistice Day, in great stomach pain, Gebhardt called Stritch. She put on her coat, over a nightgown, slipped her shoes on, and went up the back stairs. At 2:30 in the morning of November 12th, shots were heard at Beekman Towers. The police were called. They discovered Vera Stritch sitting in the stairway below the third floor. Her large handbag, they found a .32 caliber revolver, a box of bullets, and two spent shells, and a crumpled silk nightgown with fresh, wet bloodstains. "Did you shoot the man upstairs?" the cops asked. "Yes, I did," she said, "but don't ask me why." She said she was on her way to turning herself in. The police grilled her for hours, but she would say nothing more. The newspapers called Stritch the icy blonde because she wouldn't talk. The police dug into Gebhardt's background and found that he had flown in World War I's famous Richthofen squadron and was a pal of fellow pilot Hermann Göring. He held a doctorate in philosophy and political economy and made $500,000 in international business deals, but he had made the mistake, from the Nazi Germany point of view, of marrying a non-Aryan. He had, however, moved out, leaving her and two children and no divorce. The trial began on March 20th, 1936. The defense attorney, Samuel Leibowitz, had defended the Scottsboro Boys and was known to be the best criminal lawyer in the country, and he defended Stritch. Leibowitz probed each of the jurors with their knowledge of Friedrich Wilhelm Nietzsche, the German philosopher whose ideas of a super race had attracted Adolf Hitler. Nietzsche said that man shall be trained to war and women for the recreation of the warrior. All else is folly. Then, with Vera Stritch on the stand for 13 hours, Leibowitz carefully produced testimony on Gebhardt's attitude towards marriage and towards her. When she announced on the night of November 11th that she would not continue their relationship, she testified, Gebhardt threw her on the bed and raped her. Next, laughing at her, he said, "If you want to make it the last night, you had better make it a good one." And he demanded her to perform acts of sex so foreign to her and so shameful that she had been able to tell the police what they were. Now she recounted it at the assistance of Judge Cornelius Collins, but only through violent, uncontrollable sobbing. Stritch said that she had found a gun in Gebhardt's chest of drawers when she was looking for the heating pad, and so she seized it. The doctor crying, "You damned whore, I will kill you," grabbed at the gun, she said, and it went off. He fell on the bed, got up, lunged again. He shot him again. Prosecutor Miles O'Brien cross-examined her for 4 hours. She killed, he insisted in a hot fever of jealousy because Gebhardt would not give up his wife for her. She is a tigress when provoked. But unable to produce a single contradictory element in Stritch's testimony, he ended his questioning of her. The judge charge lasted 5 hours, defining first-degree murder, second-degree murder, first-degree manslaughter, reasonable doubt, excusable homicide, etc. If you believe the story that she recently, the judge was to say, if you believe her story, he added acidly, acquit her. Within 3 hours, the jury did so. The furious judge went off to his chambers without thanking the jury for their services. And the next day, the press met Stretz. "Don't let this ruin your life," said a woman reporter. "My life is ruined already," said Stretz. Years later, the defendant of this trial would be identified as one Laura Parr. When and how she changed her name from Vera Streets remains the secret buried in her ruined life. In 1941, introduced Arsenic and Old Lace, which ran 1,440 performances from January 10, 1941 to June 17, 1944. Lillian Hellman's Watch on the Rhine had a successful run of 378 performances and provided an omen of things to come. And the audio. 2 years later, a seminal Broadway event was introduced. In March of 1943, the first collaboration between Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein Jr. retooled the 1931 play Green Grows the Lilacs. You can get up and dance if you want.
Can you stop 1 minute?
Yes.
Rebecca, would you tell about your family going to these musicals? I'm sorry, Rebecca.
Eight times.
Wow.
I just thought that was normal. My father was good friends with Oscar Hammerstein for many years, and he would give us house seats.
Oh, wow.
As, you know, many times as we wanted them for Oklahoma, Sound of Music, everything. Very, very, very lucky.
Wow.
And I could just add that Rex Stout and Oscar Hammerstein worked on a number of projects that
Stand up, Carol, so they can hear you.
Oh, that Rebecca, you could probably better describe them. No. Well, anyway, they worked on a number of political projects together. And Oscar Hammerstein's many plays, in fact, most of them were, I'll just say, like South Pacific, was about interracial. And what they specifically worked on was the efforts to prevent World War III, essentially. And then had those activities had a number of catchwords for the different organizations from about 1945 till the early 50s.
Thank you, Cheryl.
Well, it's interesting, you'd mentioned the interracial thing. When South Pacific opened up, the theater owners did not want the song "You Have to Learn to Hate." That's not the right title. You have to be carefully taught. They did not want it in, and they went to Rodgers and Hammerstein and asked them to remove it, and they said no. So they went to Michener, who wrote the book, and he said no. And of course, it stayed in, and it's become a standard ever since. So. That's true. They certainly
and
did work.
King and I was also interracial.
Of course it was, yeah.
And many of his things were really quite controversial in the new day. But when we saw them in the 60s, which is what I did, they weren't controversial at all.
Right. The result transformed the book musical, a musical play where the songs and the dances were fully integrated into a well-made story with a serious dramatic background. Now entitled Oklahoma, the show began a 2,212 performance run. Agnes DeMille, in her first Broadway choreography, inserted her famous 15-minute dream ballet that changed the way dance was incorporated into musicals. Critics would later say that Oklahoma ushered in the golden age of the American musical theater. Toots Shores opened, joined Club 21 on 51st Street, and with two other neighbors, the El Morocco and the Stork Club, was the place to be seen in 1941. F. Scott Fitzgerald's Last Tycoon, left unfinished with the author's death, was edited and published in 1941 by Edmund Wilson. James N. Cain's Mildred Pierce was published. Two Nero Wolfe novels, published the year before. Where There's a Will and Over My Dead Body were still selling well. And Mayor Fiorella LaGuardia was elected for the third term of New York City's mayor. 1941 was a year of considerable debate in New York City. From many European countries, there was allegiances with both the Axis countries and the Allied countries. New Yorkers cared greatly about what was happening in Europe because they had close ties to one side or the other. Three quarters of New York City's residents were first or second generation, and many of those immigrant organizations were headquartered here and had a stake in the outcome of the military contests. The loudest debate argued, should the United States get involved in another European-Asian war? Socialists, intellectuals, many academics thought we had paid the price in World War I and should sit this one out. Others who saw the destruction of Poland and China and the collapse of Europe felt we were the only hope to stop the Axis terror. The Nazis marched, communists organized, pacifists convened, laborites rallied, businessmen lobbied, journalists reported, educators taught, and students went on strike to make their voices heard. The publishing and media concerns, international business, civic, labor, political, and religious groups also had influence to make their opinions count. And all the noise stopped on December 7th, which we'll celebrate tomorrow, or remark tomorrow. And December 8th, New York went to war. Columbia University's physics department had for 2 years researched using a huge machine called a cyclotron and managed to smash the atom and create nuclear fission. The United States was on course to develop the first world atomic bomb, and more importantly, beat Germany to developing that weapon. Keeping the home front safe fell to Fiorella LaGuardia, who doubled as the United States Director in the Office of Civil Defense until February of 1923. Armed guards patrolled sensitive areas like the Brooklyn Navy Yard. The FBI agents detained Japanese, German, and Italian non-citizens on Ellis Island for questioning and possible incarceration or deportation. And I'll throw another personal note in there. When I was in the service, we had liaison with the FBI. They told me that there were more FBI agents per square foot in the Yorkville section of Manhattan, the Upper East Side, because there was a huge German community there, than there was in any other place in the United States during World War II. Next slide. In January 12, 1942, a German U-boat commander by the name of Reinhard Hartigan steered his submarine into the New York Harbor, completely undetected by the United States Navy. Hartigan, whose ship had just sunk an Allied vessel before entering the U.S. territory, was shocked when the craft surfaced and saw New York's skyline fully illuminated. The arrogance of the New Yorkers with the skyline ablaze while the world was at war angered Hartigan and caused him to miss his target. He left New York and the East Coast, but sank another seven ships before he arrived in Hamburg to a hero's welcome. Hartigan was awarded numerous commendations and wrote a book about his wartime service. Another U-boat deposited four English-speaking German saboteurs near Amagansett, Long Island in June of 1942. They were ordered to destroy the U.S. defense installations, and they made their way to New York City. Four more Germans landed in Florida with the same intentions. Luckily, two men confessed to the FBI, and they arrested the whole group before they could cause any damage. Six of the eight were executed as spies. Next. In 1940, President Roosevelt called America to become the arsenal of democracy. When the country went to war, Americans in the home front used the nation's immense industrial infrastructure to produce ships, guns, planes that FDR had asked for. New York and its metropolitan region contributed mightily to the common cause. New York City, from the beginning of 1942 to the end of the war, became the manufacturing center of the United States. Next. Brooklyn Navy Yard, which was all of 3 acres in size when we entered the war, expanded to 17 acres by the end of the war. 70,000 people would work there around the clock. Many women leaving home for the first time, would fill jobs vacant by men in uniform. They would build, refurnish, repair, and refit ships of all sizes. Next. Airplane production in the United States in 1939 was 5,000 planes a year. In 1942, the number jumped to 50,000 planes. And the following year, it reached the unfathomable level of 100,000 planes. Republic and Grumman and smaller companies in the metropolitan area were deeply involved in that production. Next. Brooklyn-based Charles Pfizer and Company invented what would become the life-saving miracle drug, penicillin, and distributed only to military personnel during the war. At the war's end, Pfizer would produce 8% of all the penicillin in the world. Companies as varied as Bulova Watch and Brooks Brothers were so important to the war effort. The production required hiring that brought people from across the country to New York for jobs. The city grew in population as the war emphatically ended the Great Depression. Next. 2 days after, and this is touching on the on Peter and the other speaker earlier today. 2 days after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, Rex Stout formed the Writers' Board of America to carry out the request of Henry Mergenthal Jr.'s Treasury Department for assistance in selling war bonds. The organization, which became known as the greatest propaganda machine in history, was made up of thousands of writers from around the country. They agreed to help the government by writing anything from novels to songs that would promote the government of the United States and the war it caused. These writers were headed by a group of 20 authors, mainly from New York City. The WWB was partially funded by the government with subsidies that came from the Office of War Information, although they were never officially under government control. During World War II, Stout, who described himself as pro-labor, pro-New Deal, pro-Roosevelt, left liberal, worked in the advocacy group for the Friends of Democracy, and of course chaired the WWB. And also supported the embryonic United Nations. He lobbied for Franklin Roosevelt to accept the fourth term, even though he never met him in the White House. And he developed an extreme anti-German attitude and wrote a provocative essay called We Shall Hate or We Shall Fail, which generated a flood of protests after its January 1943 publication in the New York Times. The attitude is expressed by Nero Wolfe in the 1942 novella, Not Quite Dead Enough. During the latter part of the war and post-war period, he also led the Society for the Prevention of World War III, somebody had mentioned that earlier, which lobbied for a harsh peace with Germany. When the war ended, Stout became active in the United World Federalist. Next. Charles Lucky Luciano in 1943 was incarcerated in Dannemora Prison, way upstate New York. Reached out to the War Department and offered to help win the war. Luciano suggested that he could get the dock workers on the waterfront, whose union the mob controlled, to keep military authorities informed about any activity that would be deemed suspicious. He also offered help in Europe by using his criminal connections in Italy to advance the Allied causes. The military accepted Luciano's offer, and in February 1946, he was released with the understanding that he must relocate permanently to Sicily. He died in Italy, actually in the Naples airport, in 1962 of a heart attack. New York contributed to 900,000 of its citizens to the military, many of them coming from approximately the 3.3 million troops who shipped out of its Great Harbor, the country's principal war port, to the battlefields of Europe and North Africa. The war ended after 8 devastating years in Asia and the Pacific, and 6 in Europe. The Allies had won. The Germans surrendered on May 7th when formally announced the next day. On August 6th and August 9th, U.S. planes dropped atomic bombs in the New York and the Japanese cities of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. The bombs were a product of the Manhattan Project research, began in Columbia in 1939. The Japanese gave way on April 15th, officially surrendering on September 2nd, 1945, aboard the USS Missouri, a battleship that was built in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. Another side comment here. the head of the Army and Navy in Japan did not want to surrender after those two bombs were dropped. It was the emperor who forced them to do it. In the beginning of 1945, continuing for many months, crowded ships brought troops back into the New York Harbor. The city joyfully welcomed them home. Men and women who had endured the challenges of war front and home front struggled to adapt to a restoration of normal life. The Second World War was the most devastating war in history. An estimated 60 million people died. Approximately 400,000 dead from the, were Americans, including 18,000 New Yorkers. The entire world order was upended, and nations suffered incalculable human and financial disaster. Next. The United States emerged from the conflagration as the most powerful nation in the world. New York, which had contributed so much to the victory, principally through the logistic miracles of its port, emerged as the capital city. The United Nations, which was founded in 1945 to achieve international peace and security, was made headquartered here in 1952. Some wartime changes and initiatives, such as the movement of government defense contracts to the south and west, would ultimately undermine the city. Contributing to New York's strength was the influx of talented refugees. Another was the Ives-Quinn Anti-Discrimination Bill in March of 1945, the first state bill that would forbid job discrimination on the basis of race, religion, or creed. After the war, the middle class began its exodus out of the city to the suburbs, and taking with them a strong tax base whose loss hurt the city. The creativity and drive of the new immigrants helped supplant the talent of those that left, and the city, ever changing, ever evolving, continued as a shining beacon to those U.S. citizens and immigrants who aspire to greatness. Thank you very much.
I must tell you,
Ben Levinson and Heather Lannis did an incredible job of researching
that.
Yes, sir.
Thank you as well, Robert.
I used the library and the archive at the
Historical Society.
I have quickly poked around, and I haven't found any rexed out materials in the library, probably because most of your collection is from an older time period. But let me add, because you obviously are more literate with the finding aids and so forth, would you be willing to poke around a little bit?
They're sure. I mean, I'll ask the librarian and see what they have. I'm sort of at a disadvantage because the Luce Center, which is the top floor of the museum, where 40,000 objects of history are on display at any one time, is going a massive renovation. So that is, I can't look there and find something, but I will.
Well, we've been around for 37 years, and we're going to be around for at least another 37 years.
So when it's done, but I'd be happy to, sure. Well.
Mary?
I just want to do a commercial for your institution. If you, when you visit the New York Historical Society, be sure to go see the movie that plays right as you walk in.
Oh,
it is stupendous.
Eight, 18 minutes. It's absolutely wonderful.
Thank you so much. Yay.
It is a wonderful, world-famous historical, it's a great building. It's a historical building in its own right. The statue just outside, the world-famous Haifa. I mean, all kinds of wonderful
things. And they've been so great to work with us, and I appreciate it so much. So
I'm glad you enjoyed it. My pleasure.